morning, Kansas City. Welcome to Capitalist Pigs, where every week we bring you what's hot in business, the markets, and your money. My name is Chris Butler. I'm a portfolio manager with Butler Lands and Wagler. And Capitalist Pigs is produced, well, for the time being, it's going to be produced every week by Mr. Jared Carter. Tom Bamford, for those of you wondering, Tom and I have a schedule conflict, and for at least the time being, Jared Carter is going to be our producer. Jared, are you mic'd up? Or are you ready to say hello this week?
I'm ready to say hello. I hope you don't kick me off your show like you did to Tom.
Yeah, right. That did not happen.
I'm willing to find the void. Fill in the void.
That's right.
Tom can't make it work.
That's right. A big void. Big shoes to fill. And we appreciate having Jared produce the show. It was an interesting week in the market. Jared, do you have any idea what something called a Bitcoin is? Have you been paying attention to Bitcoin fever?
I do. I'm a young guy. We actually talked about it on Greg Knapp's show.
So, yes.
A young man, I'm up to date on internet currency.
That's exactly what it is. Virtual internet currency. Had a difficult week. Did you follow it this week, Jared?
I did not follow it this week, other than the two twins that are in that Facebook movie.
Right.
They are heavily invested in Bitcoin. So
that's right. That is right.
And those guys are going to be just fine.
Yeah, they're going to be doing okay at some point. They were stressing this week, however, because there was a collapse and then rally in Bitcoin prices this week. And we're going to get to that at some point in the show. We're going to talk about gold, which absolutely got hammered this week. We'll talk a little bit about that. I think it's interesting. Both Bitcoin and gold are considered alternative currencies, both getting smashed this week. Strange. Yeah, we'll talk more about it probably in the second or third segment. We had a stock market that just honey badgered out for all intents and purposes this week. Nothing could keep it down. Friday had some difficulty because of bad economic data, but for the most part, bad economic data has been viewed as good economic data because the worse our economy is, the more likely the Fed keeps printing the money, and this market is addicted to it. And I think that's why the stuff we're going to talk about today is very important. You have to understand what the economy is doing so that you can understand also how far the stock market has diverged from economic reality. First, though, I think we have to get into what went on in Japan. A lot of people do not care about other markets, other international markets, because they don't invest there. And I'm going to tell you right now, what goes on in Japan is affecting your U.S. domestic investments today. So you better pay attention to what's going on in the rest of the world, because this isn't 1975 where, you know, something that happened in China wouldn't even make our papers. Now what goes on in China, Japan, Europe does affect us, and it affects us primarily because of capital flows into and out of the United States. We will talk about that. So let's get into Japan. They, in case you missed it, announced on Thursday of last week, not this most recent one, the one before that. So what is that, about 10 days ago? They announced that they are going to engage in a quantitative easing or yen printing scheme that would make even Ben Bernanke blush. They are one-third the size of the U.S. in terms of the economy, and they're going to be doing more than we are. More easing than the United States. That's a huge deal. They will get to the size of the U.S. Fed balance sheet in 2 years, where it took the Federal Reserve 5 years. They are going to go at breakneck speed, and this has totally made, well, I was going to say totally mixed up the markets in Japan. That's not necessarily true. What it did do, though, is it announced that just about every asset class over there is going to be extremely volatile. And we've seen the Japanese bond market close, I think, every day since the announcement. They've had to shut down the bond market because prices either went way too high, way too fast, triggering a stop of trading for the day, or prices dropped of these bonds way too much in one day, and the market had to shut down. That is an amazing occurrence, but not as amazing as this. The Japanese stock market since the announcement of their quantitative easing plan is up 16%, and I think that was 1 to 7 trading days, and roughly 16%. In 7 trading days, the Japanese stock market. Unbelievable. How about this? The Japanese real estate sector, Japanese REITs, real estate investment trusts, are up 24% in the first 4 days after the announcement. And you heard that right. 24% in 4 days. So don't let anybody tell you that central bank money printing isn't affecting a stock market. There's no way the fundamentals in Japanese REITs were up 24% in 4 days. This was clearly money printing, keeping interest rates low. That brings up, you know, the what we call the carry trade. If there is certainty that the Japanese government is going to keep rates low for a while, people will go to Japan, borrow money, and either invest it in Japanese stocks or bonds, or take the money out of Japan, convert it into whatever currency they need to, and invest in, oh, let's say, the S&P 500. That is a big deal. And we are going to see money flow out of Japan. We did last week. And the reason I know this is because with every day, for every day except Friday, the Japanese yen lost value to the U.S. dollar as money flowed out. They sold yen, bought dollars, and invested here. Friday was the first day that didn't happen since the announcement of all of this yen printing going on over there. To me, that is a game changer. And I will say that the horrible employment situation report we got last Friday, where we saw that we created only 88,000 non-farm jobs, sent markets reeling here in the United States for a while. And then you got the old bad news is good news rally. But I think it was also that rally was instigated by a bunch of international dollars coming into the United States. And that is an important occurrence. Now, the markets, the equity markets in the United States did close down last Friday on that bad employment situation number, but not nearly as bad as it could have been and not nearly as bad as it was early on, right after the news. I think that for the most part of this week, you did see the U.S. stock markets go up. Friday was a bit of a problem, but for the most part, markets were up. We probably need to talk about exactly what went on there that could have caused the U.S. equity markets to appreciate. And I think this is funny. Now, let me first say that in markets, when you have a economic report that gets released, there is always every investment analyst out there talking about what they expect, and they call that, they take an average of what is expected, and they call that the consensus. The consensus was, for example, for non-farm payrolls to increase by 193,000. We got 88. That's called a miss because it was below expectations. If it's a beat, it came in better than expectations. Markets really don't move based on the actual number. They move on whether or not that number is better or worse than what was expected going into the announcement. Let's take a look at what's happened over the last 2 weeks and see if this data was a miss or a beat. Now remember, stock market's up, so you're thinking our economy is doing better. The market U.S. Purchasing Managers Index, miss. ISM Manufacturing Index, miss. ISM New York, miss. Vehicle sales, miss. ADP employment, miss. ISM services, miss. Challenger job cuts, miss. Initial claims, miss. Trade balance, beat. We beat on the trade balance. I'll have a round of applause. Non-farm payrolls, like I said, was a miss. Hourly earnings, miss. NFIB small business, miss. Wholesale inventories, miss. PPI, miss. Retail sales, miss. Consumer sentiment, not only a miss, but the worst miss ever. We were 7 points below what was expected. That is the worst miss on record in consumer sentiment. Markets, up. Now, that should just be kind of a precursor to what it is that's driving markets. Clearly, it's not the economy. It is instead money printing. And you saw it in Japan. You see it here, and it's not just dollars that are driving our markets right now. It is yen as well, or yen converted into dollars. And that means we all ought to be very wary of these levels in the stock market. They are built really not on economic fundamentals. When that happens, you have the potential for what's called a bubble, and bubbles always burst at some point. I'm not sure that we are at bubble levels just yet, but we are stretching reality, I think, is the best way to put it on U.S. equities. I had mentioned in the prior segment that we were going to talk a little bit about Bitcoin, but I thought off-air, Jared had an interesting question. Go ahead, Jared, because I'm sure a lot of people are wondering the same thing.
Well, you mentioned that the market analysts release reports, and whether the market hits their expectations,
right,
that sets up or down, right?
Mm-hmm.
I wondered, do these analysts set their expectations based on the American consumer's expectations?
Yeah. So, and why would you think that?
Well, I mean, I might just be a degenerate gambling sports fan. But like when Vegas sets a line, like the Chiefs minus 10, mm-hmm, Vegas, the odds makers don't necessarily think the Chiefs are going to lose by 10.
Right.
They just think that's the number that the American public will think is going to happen. So they want to get action on both sides.
Yeah. And it is very much like that, but they're not really polling the American consumer. They're just polling economists, and then they will take the median or average. And so you do end up with having some people, almost an even amount of people, thinking that that number will be less than the consensus estimate, and the people that think it's going to be more.
Right.
Yeah, so it is a lot like line setting in a way, but it is just an average of what economists think is going to be the number. And the way they come up with that number is it varies depending on what it is they're trying to estimate. Like, for example, retail sales. They'll look at reports for the prior week for same-store sales that get reported by the larger retail chains. Now, not everybody reports that stuff on a weekly basis, but some do. And so they're kind of extrapolating it out throughout the entire economy to come up with a number. And they all use different mathematical models to do that.
So it's like a line that's set, but only smart people matter. Unlike
that's
Vegas,
right,
which the American public, which is very dumb. That
right. Right, yeah. And that's why Vegas makes money, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah. It is very similar to line setting. You know, their crystal ball is no better than yours or mine in the end. It's just nice to know what the consensus is, because markets factor in that consensus getting hit. And when it doesn't get hit, when it beats it, markets tend to go up. When that number is not hit at all and it misses, markets tend to go down. I say tend because over the last 2 weeks, we've had a slew of misses, and markets really didn't care, because in this environment, bad news is good news. Bad news means that the central bank continues to print money, and that money generally finds itself into stocks and forces the market up, but it also forces market prices to reflect an environment that is not the environment that we're really in. Bitcoin, I think I said last week, I'll say it again, a virtual currency that trades, that you can go to a website and exchange U.S. dollars for bitcoins, euros for bitcoins, wherever you happen to live. And it is a competing currency to fiat, or what we know as fiat currency. But the difference is they have a computer program that prevents an overprinting of these things, unlike the Federal Reserve, which overprints all the time. Don't get me wrong. I said last week, I'll say it again, I actually like any currency that the Fed hates. And the Fed hates Bitcoin. And Bitcoin had a problem. It got as high as $266 per coin earlier this week, crashed down to about 100, rallied back. It was all over the map. But the parabolic rise in Bitcoin is probably over, and now you'll probably get a much more rational market. It was looking a lot like a bubble last week. Someone said that Bitcoin was like 3 or 5 cents a coin, what, 2 years ago? We just hit $266 this year. That is a parabolic rise. And I understand why people want to get into something other than fiat currency, because every central bank everywhere, at least the ones that matter, are printing supply of currency where demand is essentially the same. That's going to erode the value of that currency, and people are looking for a place to hide. Bitcoin just happened to fit the bill for a while. For a while, it was gold. I think it still is gold, frankly. We have to ask ourselves the question, is Bitcoin currency? You know, one of the things that a currency must do is it must be saleable. The problem with Bitcoin is it is generated in the internet cyberspace, and we need to have a majority of 7 billion inhabitants of planet Earth to have frequent access to the internet for this to be considered, in my opinion, anything remotely saleable. Now, maybe that day comes. It isn't right now. I don't think it rises to the definition of currency today, but it might do that in 2 years, 5 years, 10 years. I don't know. But I do know that there is it was more speculative than it was useful for the past 2 or 3 weeks. Now maybe we'll start to see Bitcoin become useful again as it got bid into the stratosphere. And a lot of it, I think, had to do, too, with what's going on in Europe. Again, understanding these foreign countries helps us understand where we're at today in our own country. I think when Cyprus had problems with their banks, and the government went in and confiscated depositors' money to help bail out those banks, something that was unexpected. You're starting to see people take their money out of banks, in Europe anyway, and wondering what they should do with it. Well, at least some of it probably found a home at Bitcoin. I think we can pretty much rule out gold. I don't think anybody was buying gold. We'll get into that actually in the next segment because we do need to take a break. When we do get back, I think what happened in the gold market this week is interesting and worthy of some discussion. Take a look at the charts we have posted. Some of them are going to be relevant to what we're talking about right now, which is gold. Gold got obliterated this week. I think it was down 20, 30 bucks Wednesday, I think. Another 60 on Friday. And that the shiny yellow metal has seemingly lost all of its luster. Gold has been struggling now since it peaked in 2011. And I know a lot of listeners of KCMO are gold investors. And so I think it behooves us to kind of talk about what's going on with gold. And it started, I think it was Wednesday that was the day that gold was down 30-some-odd dollars. It started that day with a downgrade on gold from Goldman Sachs, ironically, from Goldman Sachs, that said they expected gold to go down another couple hundred dollars by the end of 2014, and this was different than their previous downgrade, and now they're essentially what I would call one of the bigger gold bears on the street. This is interesting to me because there is a seeming disconnect between investment banks, who are all universally bearish on gold right now, and actual purchases of gold coins. Gold coins not only are trading at a premium still over gold bullion, but they're trading at an increasing premium over the shiny yellow metal, which means there is big-time demand. Anecdotally, there are stories out there of people having to wait almost 2 months to get delivery on their gold and silver coins, which leads one to conclude we may be experiencing a shortage in bullion. Seemingly does not matter. I think that there are a couple of things going on with gold right now that would concern anybody that is investing in gold, but longer term, I don't know that this matters a whole lot. Over the short term, it seems like gold is under a lot of pressure. And the point I would make first is that gold is used in, it's hard to really tell exactly how often. It's not talked about much, but gold is used to manage monetary policy. It's one of the tools that the Fed and the Treasury do have at their disposal. They don't go out and say, hey, we just sold a whole bunch of the American people's gold every time they do it. But it is within their right to do so. It is legal. And every now and again, you'll catch a Treasury employee or a Federal Reserve chairman talking about how they can, if things got to the point where they needed to, sell gold. I think that they are. And I think they're doing it mainly to offset some of the inflationary elements that come from such a massive quantitative easing program. I do think that at least some of that's going on. The other thing I think that's going on with gold is that Jeff Killer Kilborg, I think is his name, on CNBC said it best. He said, you know, gold is no longer the safe haven trade. Guess what is? The S&P 500 stocks. And I don't think he was saying that, hey, and that's a good thing. I think he was saying that tongue-in-cheek, but there's an element of truth in it. And that is, people believe that the Fed will not allow the stock market to go down. Therefore, why not be in stocks? And they're selling their gold to go into stocks. Well, I think that might be part of it. I'm not sure that it's a big enough part of it to matter, because on Friday you saw gold get blown up from 7:30 in the morning until same time, by the way, all those bad economic releases came out and stocks were down. Stocks, people were selling stocks and gold. So it's not like they were selling their gold to go into stocks. There was a massive amount of selling of gold, something that tells me that there is institutional selling of gold. This isn't mom and dad selling their GLD shares, which is an exchange-traded fund. This is institutional. And I think that, I've said this before, I'll say it again, I have never seen the sentiment in any one sector or for any one investment so bearish and so negative as it is for gold. And part of the reason I think people are perplexed by what's going on here is no one can agree on exactly what gold is. What's it used for? I mean, other than the industrial purposes, why own gold? No one can really say, because if you think gold is an inflation hedge, if you actually do the historical analysis of how gold performs in different regimes, inflationary and deflationary, it performs about the same. It does add a hedge for inflation sometimes. Sometimes it doesn't. Most of the time it does. Most of the time it does not perform well in deflationary times, but sometimes it does. I think that there's an element of gold that is attractive when people are fearful of the financial system collapsing. Sometimes that's in a deflationary period, and gold tends to do pretty well in those periods of time. I view it, rightly or wrongly, I view gold as the anti-fiat currency. The only way to measure, really, the value of a fiat currency is versus gold, because currencies don't trade in a vacuum. You can't just say, well, I wonder what the dollar's worth, and how are you going to measure that in dollars? That doesn't make sense. You have to measure the value of the U.S. dollar in terms of yen, or in terms of British pounds, or in terms of euros, and all of those are fiat currencies. So a better way to measure the value of a fiat currency, and by fiat, I mean it is currency by decree. Someone in charge has said, this is what you shall use as your currency. That's a fiat currency. The best way to measure the value of fiat currency is by gold, but you can't stop gold from going down, even if the dollar itself is going down, which, by the way, there's a very high correlation, negative correlation, meaning most of the time, dollar down, gold up. Gold down, dollar up. And this goes on for 85-90% of the time. There are periods, though, like now, where the dollar is weak, but so is gold. And I think that comes from an overwhelming number of sellers. Like I said, institutional. I don't expect that to continue if the dollar continues to be weak. And will the dollar continue to be weak versus other fiat currencies? That's the question. Because a lot of the weakness in gold prior to, say, 2 months ago, you could completely blame on a strong dollar. A two-month upswing in the dollar versus all other fiat currencies. which generally forces gold down. But not anymore. Over the last month, or at least several weeks, gold has instead gone down with the dollar, in some cases moved up with the dollar. When it does move up with the dollar, it doesn't go up very much. So I've posted some charts so that you can see if fiat currency is measured only versus other fiat currencies and gold, then you can legitimately say of the four big currencies, dollar, euro, yen, pound, gold is rallying in someone's currency somewhere right now. This might strike a lot of gold investors as crazy, but in Japanese yen terms, gold is setting an all-time high. And we just watched a fall off the face of the earth on Friday in gold priced in dollar terms. So, and, you know, like I said, sporadically, you can see if there's a huge seller that the value of currencies don't matter. Over a long period of time, you bet they do. And so if you look at these charts, what you're going to see is gold is always rallying somewhere. Just so happens it is not in the United States. It's not in dollar terms right now. It is in yen terms. And I don't recall exactly what the yen did on Friday or gold priced in yen, but as of Thursday, it was approaching all-time highs. I mean, it was just short. Because once the Central Bank of Japan announced this massive tsunami of liquidity last Thursday, you saw a huge spike in gold versus yen, or gold priced in yen terms, and it got right back up to its all-time high level. We'll see if that can hold, but generally speaking, gold is rallying somewhere. It's because those four currencies cannot all go down together because they are priced against each other. There's got to be a winner and a loser, and two also rands all the time. Therefore, gold is rallying somewhere at all times. And it's rallying, by the way, in the country that has the weakest fiat currency. So over a long period of time, I would expect that what's going on in gold probably doesn't matter a whole lot, although I think it's doing all sorts of damage from a technical standpoint and doesn't look good. Still, I mean, I would be watching gold very closely because at some point it is going to be a buy again, and which is one of the, you know, the main reason I don't like the shiny metals themselves versus the companies that mine them, although the two are attached at the hip somewhat, is because at least the mining companies have assets and there is a value that you can put on those assets. I mean, right now the mining companies are getting hurt, just not maybe as bad as gold, but they're getting hurt. The question you have to ask yourself is, are we going to stop mining? Probably not, seeing as though that's the first step in any production. I mean, you can't have a 4%, as some do, projection for second quarter GDP in the United States and think that we're going to do that without mining. It's ridiculous. So you might find some value in mining shares. We are looking at mining shares. And frankly, I would like to get more of them as the price collapses even more. Now, I think that the gold mining shares find a bottom faster than does the shiny yellow metal. Because don't forget, we also have to mine for copper, we mine for silver, we mine for gold, platinum, palladium, all of these precious metals plus industrial metals. That's what these companies do, and they've got big, expensive machines to do it. I think it's easier to find value in the shares than in the metal, which seems to be overly political right now. There is a vested interest in governments to make sure their fiat currency does not collapse. That's why I think it's very interesting that all competing currencies against the U.S. dollar did actually collapse in the same week, Bitcoin and gold. And so we are left wondering exactly what it is about the dollar that people seem to think is so fantastic. I don't know. Can't answer that. Someone else will have to, someone smarter than me is going to have to tell me at some point why the dollar is such a superior currency to all other competing currencies when we're printing them as if there is no tomorrow. I don't know. Just like anything else in economics, you increase the supply while demand stays the same. you get a lower value, get a lower price. And that's the story of your U.S. dollars right now. I do want to talk about the long-term prospects for the stock market at this point. And I had said a couple of weeks ago, actually, to anybody that was listening at Butler, Lands, and Wagler, which probably was not many.
Nobody then?
Yeah. No one checked in.
Try with me. I said, Butler, none of them.
don't try, man.
Favor for the show.
Yeah. And I was talking to whoever, and I said that you can't have record profits in corporate America for very long if we still have all these people that are unemployed and underemployed. And the point was that at some point, a company actually needs people with a job to buy their product. And if you don't get that, then maybe some companies still do extremely well. But by virtue of simple math, some companies must then fall by the wayside because there just isn't enough demand to support all of what's going on. You know, you can talk about quantitative easing. That would be a short-term fix, printing money and giving it to bankers and have them make profit free and easy on U.S. treasuries. Yeah, that does actually prop up the economy for a while, but you're creating debt to do it. You're creating inflation to do it, one or the other. And that acts as a tax on the system. I think that the part that I want to get to is that what I was saying is better said by an economist from the 1950s named Michael Kolesky. And I think that I had forgotten all about this guy, but somebody, a great economist that manages money named John Hussman, brought this up in his weekly newsletter, and I thought I'd share it with you without trying to get too technical. His point is this: there are three sectors in our economy. You got the government sector, you got the household sector, and you got the corporate sector. And this is his way of saying the same thing that I was saying a couple of weeks ago, much more articulate, I might add. What he says is basically this: profits have to move inversely to what amounts to household and government savings, because they're withholding money from the economy when they save, and it depends kind of on how they save as to the extent that they can hurt the corporate sector. But those three sectors share the same pie, GDP. And right now, by the way, corporate profits at an all-time high relative to GDP. Normally we can expect 6% of GDP to be corporate profits. Right now they're at 11, never been there before. Second highest level was 9. We achieved that frighteningly in 2007. So we're there again. And what tends to happen is that you get the savings of both the government and the household sector to start to go up. And that takes away money from the corporate sector, therefore corporate profits go down. And what happens in the end is that you see a dramatic reversal, and you start to see that money flow, in terms of GDP, into the other two sectors and not the corporate sector. At these levels, historically, we are now at 11% of GDP as corporate profits, as high as it's ever been. The bottom line is that you would expect, or at least John Hussman expects, on average, a 12% reduction in earnings or corporate profit every year for the next 4 years because of that. Because once you start to see the unsustainable leverage being reversed by both the government and the household sector, you take money away from the corporate sector and earnings fall. That doesn't bode well for the long-term prospects of the stock market. And I just wanted to read his last paragraph here in his newsletter. Put simply, stocks are not cheap, but are instead strenuously overvalued. The speculative reach for yield encouraged by the Federal Reserve has created another bubble, which is not recognized as a bubble only because distorted profit margins create the illusion that stocks are reasonably valued. We presently estimate a prospective 10-year nominal total return for the S&P 500 of less than 3.5% annually. The likelihood of even this return being achieved smoothly without severe intervening volatility and steep market losses is roughly zero. This does not imply or ensure immediate market losses, but it doesn't need to. On any horizon of less than about 6 or 7 years, we expect that any intervening returns achieved by the S&P 500 will be wiped out, and then some. Speculate if you believe that your exit strategy will dominate that of millions of other speculators, despite market conditions that are already overvalued, overbought, and overbullish. In his view, all of this will end badly, he says. That should just kind of set us up for the fact that we're in a danger zone in terms of what we can expect going forward out of the stock market. And that's how I would like to view it. Just understand that there are risks that aren't being talked about still in stocks. It's not the safe haven. It's still stocks. And there's still risk there.